Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, one of my favorite peeps in the whole world, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Is it a fast ship? It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. She's fast enough for you, old man.
Yes, to get credit for this quote, you actually have to, you can't just name the original source. You have to figure out the secondary source
right, of
that quote.
Well, and to be fair, the secondary source paraphrases the primary source.
True.
So, yes, we're going to talk today about Star Wars. This comes to us courtesy of a little listener mail. This listener mail comes from Eric, and Eric says, weeks ago, when Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday came and went, it got me thinking about his Star Wars satellite program. I know Star Wars involves satellites, and it theoretically would be able to kill any bad guy America set its sights on. However, I don't know much about how it works. Could you do a podcast on it? Thanks. P.S. Could Star Wars be able to destroy Vroomhilda and the Philosophizer? First of all, Eric, it's not an assassination system, it's an anti-missile system, and second of all, nothing can stop Vroomhilda and the Philosophizer.
At least we got that out of the way.
So maybe some bratwurst. So you want to talk a little bit about, well, I guess before we even talk about the Star Wars program, what we need to do is take a little trip in the Wayback Machine. We haven't done that for a while.
No. Did stuff you missed in history class bring it back?
We have a secondary unit. When we did the renovation on the studio space, I made sure that we got a second one just for tech stuff.
Okay, good, because they don't leave it plugged in.
Right. Well, this one over here, you'll notice it looks kind of like Okay, so it looks like a third-hand police call box, but trust me, it'll work just fine. So, let's get in.
Okay.
All right, I'm right behind you here. All right, you just budge over just a little bit. Unfortunately, this one is not larger on the inside than it is on the outside. Let's just set this for October 4th, 1957, and push the button, Frank.
I can't reach the button.
All right, I'll push the button. All right, and here we are. October 4th, 1957, in what was then the Soviet Union.
Get out. It is not roomy in here.
Oh, sorry. All right. Wow.
All right, that's better.
Hey, there's that tomb that's in Tetris. So anyway, it's 1957, October 4th, Soviet Union. You know what's about to happen?
Does it beep?
It does. In fact, that's pretty much all it does. There's going to be the launch of the Sputnik satellite, the first man-made satellite launched into Earth orbit.
Beep.
Beep, in fact. That is a direct quote.
Yes.
It's pretty much all it did was orbit the Earth and beep. But here's the other important thing about Sputnik. It was not only was it the first man-made satellite, but it made America, like the general public of America, realize that the Russians had developed technology that would not just allow them to launch a rocket into space, but theoretically launch a rocket from the Soviet Union that could go all the way and reach the United States of America.
Right. Now, keeping in mind that this is shortly after the end of World War II, or at least much closer than it is now.
Yes.
And people were still very concerned about what was dawning as the atomic age.
Yes.
With the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended the Second World War. Other countries were beginning to test those. We realized that they were terrible weapons, all of us in the world, everywhere. And, you know, all of a sudden it became a concern that other people, especially, you know, countries that were not necessarily friendly to the United States.
Yeah, the Soviet Union had undergone what can only be described as political turmoil over the decades since World War I, really.
Yes. And, sorry, I was dancing around that.
Yeah, but it's, well, we have to talk about it because the Cold War, that's what Star Wars program is all about, right?
Yes, it was.
So we had these political, the strain on the political relationship between the United States of America and the Soviet Union. They had diametrically opposing political philosophies.
Right. And now these very, very potent weapons, which are going from needing to be dropped as bombs from planes to being equipped on top of missile warheads.
Right.
We're talking about longer and longer ranges. What parts of the world can you hit with a rocket of this type?
Right.
And then suddenly there is a thing in space that is beeping. But what does that mean? Does that mean that you can hit anywhere in the world if you launch the rocket from the right, you know, at the right altitude and attitude and apogee?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Instead of having to send a bunch of aircraft to fly over a target space and drop bombs, you know, those aircraft could be intercepted and could be shot down. There were things that you could do in that case. The thought of a missile being launched across the world and then hitting your nation was much more frightening because what could you do against that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what sort of propelled the whole idea of the Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars program. Well, let's get back into the machine and get back to modern day.
Seriously?
We have to.
I'm claustrophobic, dude.
All right. Well, look, just inhale deeply and get in.
All right. Ow.
Shut up.
We've got to move this lever because it's poking me in the
Okay,
thigh.
All right. And we're back. All right, let me just get out of here. Okay, now.
Right, somebody else can have that one.
The studio seems nice and roomy now, doesn't it?
Yes, I know.
All right, so now that we're back in the present day, we can talk a little bit about what happened after the Sputnik launch. You essentially had a lot of research and development poured into these long-range missile programs. Eventually, the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, or ICBM, became a product of this.
Right.
So this began what was a philosophy that was called later mutual assured destruction.
Is it a is it any coincidence that the initials spell MAD?
Well, you had to be mad to follow it, right?
So the idea being that whoever has the most weapons gets to scare off everyone else from attacking you because we have more than you.
Yeah, the idea being that really the idea came down to each side of this opposing philosophy, this Cold War, so-called because there weren't outright hostilities breaking out, that you had to have enough weapons to ensure that you could destroy your enemy. And both sides had it. And the idea being that with both sides having these weapons, it would be crazy to actually launch an attack because you would know that you would also be attacked and that you would suffer just as your enemy suffered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was the mutual assured destruction. The idea that it's so dangerous to launch an attack, no one would dare do so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Problem is that relies on humans acting in a rational way. And that, of course, is not always the case. In fact, you could argue that this was the same philosophy that existed in Europe prior to World War I, mm-hmm. that European nations were building up armed armies and navies. They were really pouring money into their armed forces with the idea being that if you had a very strong armed force, no one would ever dare attack you. So therefore, just by increasing tensions, by increasing the size of your military, you could ensure peace, even though it would be a very tense peace. Unfortunately, as World War I proved, that did not work. So we tried it again with nuclear weapons.
Right. I think just for the sake of clarification right now, I would say it's safe to say that hasn't gone away.
No,
there
no.
are still huge nuclear stockpiles in the United States and in
Russia,
the former Soviet Union,
yeah. and
many other countries around the world now.
And even though the Soviet Union itself collapsed, you could say that the political and the political attitude in the former Soviet Union is once again at least somewhat antagonistic towards the United States government. Right. There are political tensions between the United States and the countries that were in the former Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can see even some of our younger listeners will probably remember the tension if you follow the news at all. And I recommend that you do.
Yes.
The tension generated from North Korea's fairly recent tests in the last two or three years where they were testing nuclear weapons and missile technology.
Yes.
Both. And, you know, of course, this causes a lot of tension with South Korea.
And Japan.
Mm-hmm. But also for other countries around the world, even Europe, which, you know, probably you wouldn't think, well, you know, they're pretty far away. You know, still, it affects, these things are no longer local conflicts with this technology. So, you know, the ideas, it hasn't gone away, certainly.
Right. You still have these political ideologies that are in opposition with each other. But then you also have, like, global corporations that span multiple countries, some of which have these political ideologies that conflict with the corporation's home country.
Mm-hmm.
It's made matters much more complicated. It's not just political. It's financial. And, you know, of course, we're all nuclear weapons are non-discriminatory, right? They don't mm-hmm. they don't target just military installations, military personnel. These are weapons that target enormous areas and essentially are going to wipe out massive civilian populations were they to be hit by a nuclear attack.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what spawned this idea of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And you actually looked at the announcement that kind of unveiled this to the world, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I and in doing the research for this, you can actually date the Strategic Defense Initiative mm-hmm. back to a specific date, although really the idea goes back farther.
Right.
But when people are picking a significant date in the history of the SDI, most pick March 23rd, 1983, when President Ronald Reagan addressed the country on issues of national security. Now, a while back, I had found a series of podcasts on presidents that were being offered by, I believe, PBS. They were free. So I downloaded and watched several of them. And Reagan's two terms were during my lifetime, but I don't remember a lot about him and what he was like. And from what I understand, he, you know, although I think a lot of people see him as sort of a militarist in some respects, mm-hmm. because he did stress in this message, you know, look, we've got to be tough. We want to deter our enemies. But I think he was also, he kind of didn't like the stress, from what I understand. He the stress that that brings on, because it's a stressful environment.
Yeah.
You're always wondering if you have more weapons than the other people, if your arms caches, if you have more soldiers and sailors and Marines.
Yeah, looking at
stressful.
Yeah, you start looking at statistics like if we were hit by a first strike, how many of our weapons would remain operable so that we could strike back? I mean, when you're looking at that scenario, you're already saying we've been hit and we've lost a massive amount of our infrastructure, our citizens. We've taken huge losses. Can we strike back? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have to ask yourself that question, that's a tough question, because you're already talking about defeat in a way.
Mm-hmm.
No one wins in that situation, right?
Right. So he in this particular speech wasn't a particularly long address,
mm-hmm.
But
yeah, it was
about
4 minutes, I think.
Yeah, it's not very long, and it's easy to find. But it's kind of interesting because it takes a different tack, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Basically said, look, I want to offer you a different idea, an idea that might bring you hope, rather than trying to destroy our enemies outright necessarily. Why don't we embark on a plan to intercept and destroy these weapons before they reach us? And that means we don't necessarily have we can focus instead on protecting ourselves rather than destroying our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Although, to be sure, I'm sure that he wanted to rely on mutually assured destruction to some degree as a defense initiative. And I think, you know, frankly, you could argue that it does have some value.
Right.
But, you know, he said, look, let's do something new and use. We've got a lot of technology available to us to make sophisticated weapons and defense systems. Let's create a network of defenses that will intercept and destroy nuclear weapons before they could actually reach us.
Right.
And, you know, he doesn't really get into a lot of the details in the address.
No, that comes later.
And
although I think it only took the next day before someone called it the Star Wars program.
Yeah, it didn't because, you know, there are a lot of pieces to it. And
yes.
It's a lot of it is about, you know, weaponizing space, essentially.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Where you're saying, let's put stuff in the sky that can shoot other stuff out of the sky.
Right. And of course.
But it's not just about that.
No,
there were ground
no.
defenses, there were airborne defenses, there were spaceborne defenses,
yes.
All as part of this overall network. And it's not even that simple, because it shifted over time.
Yes.
To mean different things during different presidencies.
And different departments took over parts of what was originally all part of the Strategic Defense Initiative. Some of that broke off and became specifically an Air Force initiative. So it was no longer part of SDI. It was a different program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you think about it, like, how are you going to do that? How are you going to stop missiles before they even, you know, come down and hit the Earth?
And there were a lot of proposals.
So it seems, pardon the not pun, but weird pun-like thing, pie in the sky sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I am thinking of a giant pie stopping missiles. But yeah, they're going, what are you going to spend money on that's going to do this? Yeah, I've lost him. So yeah, it was supposed to stop ICBMs from reaching the United States.
Right.
Now, part of it was, hey, if you can destroy it in space before it even reenters the atmosphere, because, you know, some ICBMs do. They reach space.
Yeah, low orbit. And then at their peak, they are in a low orbit, and then they reenter on a trajectory toward their target.
Yes. That's why they're intercontinental.
Yes.
But yes, there are other weapons that don't reach that altitude.
Right. And it's interesting, because if you look at the history and the various proposals that were all part of SDI, you start to realize that they were figuring this out as they were going along as well. Like,
mm-hmm.
there were originally a lot of the idea was that, well, we can, as long as we can shoot down the missile or destroy the missile before it makes contact, then that's acceptable. Except for the fact that there was the discovery of, hey, these blasts are releasing ginormous electromagnetic pulses, or EMPs.
Right.
And that means that were you to detonate a nuclear weapon, even at a fairly high altitude over the United States, that EMP could end up affecting the electronics on the ground or even in the air. So you're talking about all the airplanes that may be in the area. You're talking about all the electronics in the area, like the power grid in the area. It could create blackouts in over a massive range because, I mean, a big enough EMP could put a load not just on that region's a power grid, but the neighboring regions as well. So, you know, we did an entire podcast about EMPs in the past. So if you really want to know more about them, I recommend you check that out because it's an interesting tactic as well as just a side effect of the nuclear war, arms program in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that kind of led to discussions about, well, what we really need are defense initiatives that would allow us to shoot down missiles as close to when they launch as possible. Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly clear, I mean, if you go to the Department of Defense, they have unclassified documents.
Yes. Lots of them.
Lots of them that you can read. And there's one that's a memorandum for the Secretary of Defense that is the space component of U.S. military strategy and warfighting requirements for U.S. military space systems. Mm-hmm. That document makes it very clear. They're talking specifically about the Soviets. Mm-hmm. The term Soviets appears multiple times through this document.
Yes.
Which is several pages long. It was written in 1988. So, you know, there were no illusions. This was not, you know, some sort of vague defense system that was meant to protect the United States from any attacker. This was something that was talked about with the Soviets in mind in particular.
Right.
So part of that was talking about, you know, you mentioned, Chris, that there were going to be ground-based systems as well as ones in space and
right.
in the air.
Mm-hmm.
This meant that your ground-based systems were essentially things like radar stations
yeah.
where you could detect that a missile had launched because missiles were going at altitudes that were high enough to be detectable by radar.
Mm-hmm.
The space element eventually came to the conclusion that there needed to be satellites that would be positioned directly over the Soviet Union in order for this to be effective so that we could launch a countermeasure from space to interfere with the ICBMs.
Right. And, you know, there were several systems that were going to rely on one of your favorite technologies.
Lasers?
Yes.
Actually, I would argue, at least, I don't know about you, Chris, when I was a kid in the 80s, my perception, and granted, remember, I was a kid.
Exactly.
I only knew about this kind of because adults talked about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as a kid, I always imagined that the Star Wars program was all about lasers. I never knew as a kid during the time when this was actually happening that that was just one of many proposals. But to talk about the lasers, the system that was proposed, the initial one with X-ray lasers,
mm-hmm.
was really, really kind of interesting and ultimately people like scientists and military personnel determined that it was not feasible. But
mm-hmm.
the idea was that you would launch satellites into orbit, position them over the Soviet Union. These satellites would actually contain a nuclear warhead inside the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
The satellite would also contain lasing material. You might want to go back and listen to our lasers podcast to hear about lasing material, but that the nuclear explosion when you detonated the warhead would provide the energy that would emit an extremely powerful X-ray laser using this lasing material, and that you would include lots and lots of lasers in a single satellite, like two dozen of them in there, so that they could shoot down multiple targets from one detonation.
Mm-hmm.
I believe at the time the United States had estimated that the Soviet Union had lots and lots of warheads, but only, I think, fewer than 2,000 actual missiles.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that you had to have enough satellites to shoot down the majority of those 2,000 or so or fewer missiles in order to protect the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to shoot them down, you would have to detonate a nuclear warhead within this satellite and have it contained in such a way that the energy is then directed into a lasing medium, shoots an X-ray laser. The X-ray laser hits the missile and shoots it down.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, of course, you also have to have a tracking system. You have to figure out how you're going to track it. Originally, I think they were looking at radar, but then there was the possibility of having the Soviet Union launching decoys using radar reflectors so that the radar would have false readings saying, oh, here's a missile over here. And by shooting lots and lots of these up in the air all at once, it would mean you would waste a lot of your defense initiative shooting down dummies, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a talk about using sensors that would detect heat signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And you would see the heat signature from a missile is going to be much larger than a decoy.
Right.
So then you just aim for the big ones, right? But this is a non-trivial problem, figuring out not just how to make the laser work, which, by the way, no one really ever figured out a reliable way of doing that,
mm-hmm.
but figuring out the targeting system so that you can reliably target and shoot down these missiles without missing them, because that energy is going to keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
If you miss that missile, it's going to hit something else.
Stupid physics.
Yeah. And we're talking X-ray lasers. I mean, this is real. X-ray lasers powered by a nuclear explosion. This is a very powerful beam of light.
Mm-hmm. And then you had, the brilliant pebbles.
Brilliant pebbles, yes.
Which were the basically autonomous spacecraft.
Yes.
Just sort of coasting around up there looking for stuff to shoot down or collide with.
Yeah. A lot of it was kind of the idea of not necessarily even shooting something down, but just putting something in the way of the missile so that it would end up destroying itself or falling to the earth. Something like that where you're not necessarily trying to destroy the missile in midair.
Mm-hmm.
There were several missile systems that were proposed where you would actually shoot a missile from space to the ICBM to destroy it. And the idea being that you wouldn't need as much fuel for the individual missiles or rockets or whatever you want to call them in the satellites that would be housing these weapons systems, because they don't have to escape the Earth's gravity. They just have to be aimed at the right direction and fired. Some of them would have tracking ability so that they could change direction in mid-flight. I saw proposals for a rail gun system.
Mm-hmm.
Rail guns, in case you were wondering, use electromagnetic energy to propel a projectile down a pathway.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually, it's the same sort of thing like particle accelerators, right?
Right.
With a particle accelerator, for example, the Large Hadron Collider,
mm-hmm.
you want to accelerate a proton beam faster and faster and faster around a circle until it reaches the right speed where you make it collide with another proton beam traveling at the same speed but in the opposite direction.
Right.
You do that by using magnetic force, because protons are positively charged. So you use a negative charge ahead of the proton to pull it, or a positive charge behind the proton to push it.
Mm-hmm.
And you increase that frequency until it's moving at near the speed of light. Well, the railguns work on a similar idea, except you're using a physical projectile and you're using electromagnetic energy to shoot the projectile out of the system. The big problem there was that even though it was possible to make a railgun, at the time it was they could only fire infrequently. Like, we're talking like once a day or once every couple of weeks, because it just took so much energy to generate that and to make it work that you couldn't just reload and fire and fire and fire. So in order for that system to work, it would, of course, have to be able to fire lots of times in a short time frame. You'd also have to figure out, all right, well, what kind of projectile are we using? We have to have one that, if we're shooting it from space, the projectile has to be able to survive re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, there were a lot of problems with that. So we were talking about missile systems, projectile systems, laser systems. There were even systems that suggested nets,
mm-hmm.
like either missiles that would deploy a net that would foul an ICBM and cause it to detonate, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we looked into this, and we being scientists and engineers, the more it appeared that, at least based on the 1980s technology and even 1990s technology, this did span more than a decade. And in fact, some of the elements are still in place in the United States military. It just became clear that there was no easy or feasible or cost-effective way of deploying this.
Mm-hmm.
You eventually had to come to the conclusion of, does it make sense to pour billions and billions of dollars, or as Carl Sagan would put it, billions and billions of dollars into a program that you might not ever use.
Right, right. And It did receive some initial funding from Congress.
Yes.
I mean, back in the 1980s, people were behind the idea and you know, jumped on the chance to fund this project. But, I mean, immediately or seemingly immediately out of the gate, there were people criticizing the idea as being too expensive, too difficult, too, pardon the pun, otherworldly. It's like, how are we, you know, this is foreign to us. And it earned, you know, it earned the program the nickname, you know, Star Wars. It earned Reagan the nickname Ronnie Reagan.
Well, not only did it seem like it was unlikely to happen, but there were people who were saying if we did have this in place, it would actually potentially lead to a nuclear war. Because,
yes,
because you would either the side that has the technology would say, hey, now we have the advantage. We can launch an initial attack against our enemy, and we have the defenses in place to prevent most of their missiles coming over here, so we should just wipe them out because we can do it now.
Yeah.
And then the other side of the argument is the enemy, the Soviets, could say, hey, they're putting this defense initiative in place. If we don't attack now, we're going to be at a weakened position, so we should attack before they get the defense system up.
Yes.
And then you actually end up causing the very event you're trying to prevent.
Yes. And the Soviets were working on their own version of the system. It escalated tensions in the Cold War.
Yeah.
Because suddenly we were embarking on this new project,
mm-hmm,
that was very scary, because all of a sudden and Reagan was right in that it does take some of the sting out of the mutually assured destruction. So all of a sudden they're going, wait a minute.
That's what we
can
do.
Shoot at them, and then once they neutralize all our weapons or most of our weapons, they can shoot back.
Or they can shoot at us before we can even shoot at them, and then they shoot all our stuff down.
Exactly.
Either way, so, that's bad for us.
Yes. So that escalated tensions just that much more. And the Soviets were working on their own system.
Yeah.
Which came to light years later. But,
and there were scientists and engineers who argued even at the beginning that really the answer to this was not building a SDI system, but using diplomacy, mm-hmm, to try and end the Cold War. And as we know, that eventually did happen, although you could argue that we're in a new Cold War now,
mm-hmm,
or at least the beginning stages of one. But the diplomacy was what several people had advocated for. And actually, that when that started to work, when the Cold War began to kind of unravel, that was bad news for the SDI initiative,
mm-hmm,
which, by the way, it underwent several name changes. I'm just going to say SDI because it's easier. I don't want to,
sure,
keep on going back and forth. But it meant that getting funding for those programs was more and more difficult because there seemed to be less of a need for one. You started to have, mm-hmm, nuclear disarmament programs, which, you know, that decreased the need for a space warfare initiative. Some of those elements, though, still got funding and continued to be an important part in military strategy. I mean, mm-hmm, a lot of our spy satellites came out of that program.
Mm-hmm.
And we've developed sensors and GPS systems that were initially in one way or another tied into SDI. And, mm-hmm, we've benefited from those. So,
yeah,
not everything in SDI was impossible or too expensive or unnecessary.
Right, right. And some of it does, you know, have clear application. Now, I should point out, I was curious about the GPS connection. And GPS did exist,
mm-hmm,
in forms before SDI. So,
yeah.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is a GPS system is really very necessary to make something like SDI work,
yes,
if you were ever to do that.
Yes.
Also, it spawned a game for the Amiga called SDI, which is very much about what this would have been about if you could just make it happen.
Also Missile Commander. And we should point out that some of the philosophies here have been used in a smaller capacity. Like,
mm-hmm,
instead of it being a global system, there are theater systems. And when I say theater systems, I'm talking about regions in which there is an active conflict.
Right.
So, for example, in the first Gulf War,
mm-hmm,
and the first war in Iraq, we saw the Patriot system.
Mm-hmm.
And the Patriot missile system, that was designed to shoot down incoming missiles.
Yeah, anti-missile missiles.
Yes. So that was a direct descendant from the SDI program. It's just,
mm-hmm,
it was a smaller surface-to-air missile system as opposed to one launched from space.
Mm-hmm.
But the Patriot system, that came directly out of the SDI initiative. And another thing that I wanted to point out is that we're at a point now where a lot of the technology that was talked about back in 1983
mm-hmm.
is completely feasible and possible now, right? We've technologically advanced to the point where from a hardware perspective,
right,
we could achieve many of the things that were proposed during the initial SDI announcement.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still some other problems, not just the political problems and the ideological problems, but actual technical problems. And I read an article in Time magazine. The article was called Computers, Star Wars, and Software. Mm-hmm. It was written in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, there was a computer scientist named David Parnas, who was a part of a committee that worked on there was an advisory panel for this initiative. In Time, it just refers to it as the Star Wars program.
Right.
And Parnas said that he resigned from the panel out of frustration because he felt that the goals they had were unachievable. And his perspective was that there was, in order for this system to work, to have a multi-satellite system designed to shoot down missiles, incoming missiles, meant that you would have to have a software program so complex it would be the largest and most complex program ever written, and you would have to have the most advanced computer system in the world to mm-hmm. run it, because you would have to be able to identify, target, and eliminate so many missiles in such a relatively small time frame that it would be incredibly difficult, and it would need to work perfectly the first time it was used, because if it didn't, how do you test that? You can't really test it
mm-hmm.
until it's necessary. And his point is that no software program ever works perfectly the first time you use it. You have
right.
to, you run a program, you see where it works, where it doesn't work, you do quality assurance, you test it, you write down all the things that don't work, you go back to the drawing board, you start reprogramming it, you run it again, see if anything's fixed. Maybe you broke something even worse this time.
Mm-hmm.
And his point is that you don't get that chance with this system. And if the system is not guaranteed to work perfectly, if it has to be this complex, if it requires the most advanced computer system in the world, you're talking about costs for something not guaranteed to work, and that therefore it is not a worthwhile endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
You should not pour that huge amount of money into something that may not ever work, and it may actually escalate things to the point where there's a legitimate conflict.
Right, right. It's funny now. It seems much less of a big deal, but I remember a lot of stuff going on in the news
yeah.
and just constant talk about the Star Wars program, and people still mention it now in legislative sessions about mm-hmm. sort of as a, this didn't work. But, I think I doubt you could really say this is the end even.
No.
I mean, some of it did survive, and some of it is pretty successful.
Yeah.
It's just not really in the way that it was originally envisioned.
Yeah, not as a complete package.
And not as a complete package. But, if it serves as a defensive deterrent against having other people launch attacks against you, it seems like the idea behind that is valuable.
Yeah, the concern now tends to be more toward, first of all, theater operations.
Sure.
So things that are happening in localized areas, mm-hmm. you're still worrying about those. But also, we have a whole new world now where we're talking about worrying of things like briefcase bombs.
Yes.
Where you're talking about, you've got all these warheads that were laying around, some of which were never installed in missiles because, like I said, they had more warheads than they had missiles to launch with them.
Yeah.
And then not all of them are necessarily accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
And then so there's a worry that there may be warheads out there in the world that could be used for terrorist purposes.
Mm-hmm.
No SDI is going to prevent that, because we're talking about, deploying an explosive device, a nuclear device, without ever launching a missile.
Yeah. And an SDI isn't going to protect soldiers from IEDs, improvised explosive
devices. Yeah.
Things that are much smaller in scale.
Right.
Or people who are willing to sacrifice their lives for their cause
right.
to the point where they will walk into a building and blow it up. You know, you can't defend against that with something like an SDI.
And even SDI at its like the best case scenario for SDI was not all about stopping every single missile.
Mm-hmm.
It was about stopping most of them.
Right.
Which would mean that no matter what, I mean, realistically, you have to say no system is perfect. You would not be able to stop everything. And therefore, there would be losses.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a question of, were the losses going to be mitigated enough for the system to be worthwhile?
Mm-hmm. So, wow. It's
heavy topic.
Yeah, it really is.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting program that was put into place. And you can see why it was, mm-hmm. even though ultimately it may have been the wrong direction to move in. I mean, at that point, the political pressure and the fear in the United States. I mean, I remember as a kid that the Soviets were supposed to be the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even if no one directly said that. I mean, here's all I have to say. Wolverines. Of course, now people are going to think that means North Korea, because the new movie is going to have the North Koreans as the bad guy. But
I see.
Yeah. But originally they were the Soviets in the original version of that film. I'm sure some of you are going to have to look up what that movie is.
Bonus quote.
Yeah, Wolverines. Yeah, that's a nice hard one because it's one word.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that it's also a very famous one. So, yeah, I mean, there was a very real concern both in the news and in pop culture that the Soviets were up to dangerous activities, and it was our duty as Americans to make sure we supported every option we had to try and head that off.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the whole patriotism directed toward supporting militarism, I mean, it's a sticky subject to talk about,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, anyway, hope you guys found that interesting. I personally think that that's a fascinating era of history.
Yeah.
And hopefully one that we will not see necessarily repeated in the future.
Yep.
Because that's not cool. Guys, if you have any other questions, like you want to know about other specific historical eras and the technology involved in them, let us know. I mean, you know, we've covered, 1510 and the Soviet American Cold War. So there's stuff in between that
yeah.
we can talk about. Let us know. Send us an email at techstuff@howstuffworks.com or let us know on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is techstuff, HSW, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.